Following program, Real Estate Radio, is brought to you in part by Trusted Agent USA. The views and opinions expressed therein do not necessarily reflect those of NewsWeb Radio or his management.
Welcome to Real Estate Radio, hosted by the real estate therapist, Larry Shagman, a top-producing real estate broker, author, CEO, and founder of TrustedAgentUSA.com, the ultimate real estate matchmaker, connecting you with top-performing agents for 2% commission. Each week, we bring you exclusive interviews with industry experts, covering everything from staging to negotiation strategies to home inspection issues and everything in between. Whether you're selling your home, a first-time homebuyer, or a seasoned investor, we've got you covered. Let's make your real estate dreams a reality in this fast-moving and ever-changing real estate market. This program is funded in whole or in part by Trusted Agent USA. Illinois license number 475-145-795. Now, here's Larry.
This is Dylan Kramer coming to you live from the studios of real estate agents and mortgage professionals who are licensed, and those numbers are shrinking, particularly on the mortgage side. And so we're getting to the point where I think two things are relevant. The first one is that the business is getting right-sized, right? I mean, especially the mortgage business, when so many folks lost their jobs in the immediate aftermath 4 years ago of COVID, we had a situation where there was a lot of refinancing activity, and if you could learn a script and could sell a little bit, you could work out of your house, and some call center companies would send you a computer and just set you up at your house, and you could sell refinances to folks, and all you had to do was get licensed, and the bar to entry wasn't that tough. But now that the market's gotten challenging, you are finding yourself in a situation where you find yourself in a situation where rates have gone up, and if you don't have business relationships, then you're going to struggle to do business. And those folks kind of hung on for a year or two, or maybe even three. But as the national renewal deadline came up at the end of December last year, it just didn't make sense for some folks to renew those licenses. So I saw a statistic that there were 400,000 plus licensed mortgage originators in the country in 2020, 2021, and in 2023, in the fourth quarter, there were 235,000 roughly. And today there are about 135,000, and I'm one of them. And so that makes us survivors, and it makes us professionals who are playing the long game, I think, by definition. And so when you reduce the numbers of people competing for the business by 75%, you end up in a situation where the remaining 25% of us have to be really, really good. And so I would argue that the best of the best is in the marketplace now. The cream rises to the top. Whatever cliche you want to put out there, that's a strong number. The same thing, I think, is going to happen on the real estate side of the business. And largely that's as a result of the National Associations of Realtors settlement with that's come up in the last couple of, really over the course of the last week or so. Remember that they've agreed that, in a nutshell, that they're going to unbundle the seller's agent fee from being just locked down and committed to the buyers, and that there's a potential that buyers may have to negotiate their own fee. The lawyers will work out what this ultimately looks like. I think that that's definitely something that I'm no expert on, but it's a real thing in the marketplace. And now that this NAR settlement has come down, I do think that there is going to be a significant reduction in the numbers of real estate professionals, much like the numbers of mortgage professionals, especially if we end up in a place. I saw some articles online where there was some conversation, and I think this is good for the consumer, the home buyer. Over the course of the review, I learned that, the United States of America has the highest real estate cost per transaction at roughly 5%, right? I mean, you know, there's a negotiation. People have said, oh, 6% real estate commission. You know, that hasn't been the standard price. And certainly here in the Chicago market, if you have a difficult to sell property, right, you have a high end $1.5 million house that has a very limited market of potential buyers. If you have a rougher condo that, you know, the association isn't in fantastic shape and a whole bunch of things, you may end up paying 6%. But on average, the home selling public, if you will, sells for about 5% and 5.1. And at the end of the day, that's a good number and probably a realistic number in the marketplace. So given that, I think that is still the highest in the world. There are a lot of countries out there that are paying between 2 and 3.5% on the real estate transaction. And there's no rhyme or reason as to how that gets broken up, right, in those markets. So let's just say there are few thousand dollars that are available for money savings that can go to the home buyer and potentially save money in the transaction. It's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. But I think that, you know, one of the things that has happened is you've had some part-time real estate agents in the marketplace who kind of hang out and do 2 or 3 transactions a year. And if they're going to make 2.5% on $500,000, 3 times a year, like, that's worth it. They have a job and an office to go to, and they, you know, they get the chance to, you know, make their car payments for the year on those 3 transactions and, you know, write their car off against their business because they're out showing houses, but they're not necessarily committed to driving the bus aggressively on, you know, kind of having a professional business. So I think it is going to both save money for the end consumer and make it more competitive, leave the professionals, probably leave to a better level of service. So with that said, I think that these are the things that are going to happen kind of in the marketplace from the NAR settlement. And I think that that's a good thing overall. But as we segue, I want to talk about a couple other things. So actually, before I segue and talk about a couple other things, I want to remind you that if you have any questions about mortgages, real estate, the current market, whatever's going on, we'd love to talk to you this morning at 773-763-9278. Got any questions about the market in general, about your specific situation? Don't hesitate to call in. We'd love to talk to you. So this week, we had a couple of things in the news. With Election Day, one of the things I think that it was very, very interesting is that Mayor Johnson was pushing for a new tax on the real estate transaction. And I won't bore you with the details, but let's just say that he was looking to charge higher end properties over $1 million, a larger real estate transaction fee. And, you know, you can argue, I think ultimately the argument here is that, hey, you know, folks with more money, higher values, are going to turn around and need to pay more money for other services. And on one level, the spirit of that, I don't want to argue that their heart's in the right or wrong place on that. But what I tell you is, I don't think ultimately it's an effective way to gain that tax money. I think ultimately the real estate transaction is pretty expensive. If you look, you know, we had a borrower who's buying in the city proper yesterday, is buying a condominium in the heart of the city in the River North area. It's a $350,000 condo. And for that $350,000, it is a 1 bedroom, 700-800 square feet type condo. It is a walk to the office type condo for somebody who works downtown, which this buyer does. And the taxes on the front end of that transaction, just kind of disclosing it, were almost $3,000. But if you add to that, the title charges were 4, and, you know, the lender charges were another 2, And all of a sudden, just to buy a $350,000 condo, this buyer is in for almost $10,000 in transaction fees. And that's ultimately a thing, these transaction fees, that can slow the economy. So if you come in and you say, hey, if your property's over $1 million, you could argue, and I guess, you know, $1 million, don't get me wrong, it's a big number. But when you talk about $1 million, you're not finding yourself in a situation where that's an astronomical amount of money. It's not an out of reach amount of money. As a matter of fact, if you were buying a 2-unit in Lincoln Park, you're probably spending $1 million. You're buying a 3-unit in Logan Square, you're easily spending $1 million. And in most other areas of the city, whether that's Jefferson Park, whether that's out on the south side, as soon as you start talking 3 and 4 units, you could easily get to $1 million. And the folks who are buying those type of properties are not millionaires by definition. The fact of the matter is, the way the lending guidelines work is, if you probably have about $150,000 in income, maybe $120,000, which on some levels it's, you know, I mean, $120,000 a year, there are a lot of civil servant type jobs that will pay that, you know, police officers, firefighters, teachers. But then you can use the rents to qualify for that type of loan from the other units that you don't occupy. So you could easily borrow the money necessary to finance a $1 million purchase on a civil servant type of income. And what I mean to say there is, this is not a rich people tax that has been shot down. And if you turn around and add another, you know, again, on a $1 million property, those numbers that I mentioned, a $10,000 transaction tax, more like 30. You add another $5,000 to it. You add another $7,000 to it. It's a real problem, because it just gets really expensive for the buyers. And one of the things that we're struggling with in today's real estate market, we've talked about it all over the winter, and it's causing the inventory problem that we have in the marketplace right now, and that is, there's not enough inventory. People are unwilling to transact. One of the reasons they're unwilling to transact is, and we've talked about it over time on this show, they've got cheap financing in place, but it's not the only reason. The fact of the matter is, people overlooked a lot of expenses when rates were cheaper and their values were increasing at a rapid pace, and they were willing to turn around and move. You know, I live out in the western suburbs, and in the western suburbs, from as near in as Elmhurst to out to Naperville or Elburn, people will move across their subdivision. They'll move 2 blocks west and 3 blocks north to get an extra bedroom, an extra garage space, a finished basement, whatever it is, because by the time you spend $20,000, $40,000, $80,000 to make the improvements to your existing house and live through the construction project of that sort of rehab, you could just buy a new place and move for $20,000, $40,000, $80,000, and the financing wasn't all that much more expensive. Well, now, if you add the financing costs and the transaction costs, you're going to find yourself in a situation where you have a real problem. It's too expensive transactionally. So I'm 0% surprised that Mayor Johnson was able to unable to get this new tax passed. I would imagine that some version of it is going to show up in you know, the legislation or at the city council or whatever the case is. But I would make a plea at this point in time to look at ways to reduce transaction taxes and transaction costs and eliminate the friction of those transaction costs as an inducement to get people to transact. I really think that ultimately there are not a lot of great ideas and in terms of transactions, which, for example, let's talk about President Biden's latest initiative that they're discussing, came up in the State of the Union. And it's the idea that you can basically get a tax deduction for $10,000 over the next 2 years if you buy, if you give up your 3% mortgage or 3.5% mortgage and move to the current rates. And on one level, that's not bad, right? That's $400 a month that can make a difference. But I would argue this. If you bought your house for $350,000 a couple of years ago and your payment's roughly $2,000, if you're going to upgrade your house is now a 350 house, so you're going to sell it for 350-ish. And then you're going to have to, what's going to take you to buy the next house? It's going to take you another $100,000. So now you're going to buy a 450 house, which means you need to borrow the gap more than likely, unless you've saved an astronomical amount of money. You're going to have to borrow the gap between the 350 you're selling and the 450 or more that you're purchasing at. And when you do that, you're going to add at least $1,000 a month to your monthly payment between the increase in the loan, the increase in the property taxes, and what I mean increase in the loan, the increase in the size of the loan, as well as the rate. It's at least $1,000. And so there's no way in my mind that a $400 a month tax credit is going to incentivize a significant portion of the public to go out and transact and put themselves in a situation where they are going to say, hey, let me take this down. Let me transact. Look, people will move when it's time to move, whether they need to get their kids in a school district, whether they need to get their kids in the right high school, whether their kids have graduated and they are going to downsize. People will absolutely move, but they're not going to move and bear an extra $1,000 a month in expenses because you're giving them $400 to do so. It's silly. And so it's another, it's another way that, government entities, politicians don't learn the lessons of the past. Ronald Reagan once said, and I completely agree with it, the worst thing that you could ever hear is somebody who shows up and says, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And so with that said, let's talk a little bit about a quasi-federal conversation, and that is the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve policy meeting wrapped up on Wednesday, and they announced no change to their current interest rate policy. However, it appears that the mortgage market or the bond market and the public at large kind of got excited about the rate cuts that are coming, and by extension, potentially lower mortgage rates coming in the future. And I hate to rain on that parade, and it sounds like I'm being sour here all morning, but I'm just trying to be realistic. That's not a thing. So let me tell you why. Before I do tell you why, I want to remind you that the Fed is in charge of the overnight lending rate, right? And that overnight lending rate is literally the shortest rate in the market. He Powell, is in charge of the rate that banks like Citibank, Bank of America, Chase, the rate they use when they have cash flow deficits with each other in the overnight lending market. You know, one bank clears too many checks against the other and they need to borrow $10 million overnight. That's the Fed's rate. And so when they turn around and move that interest rate, it's a little bit like a seesaw on the playground, right? It's a related rate, but they don't directly control mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are controlled by the bond market, specifically the market for mortgage-backed securities. Again, literally the longest rate available to consumers in the market is the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. So bond traders go to work every day, and their work results in a rate that can sometimes be in line with the Fed decision, but not always. So after the Fed announcement and Mr. Powell's press conference this week, the MBS market has improved mildly at best. The market's generally unimpressed with this. Why? Well, two reasons. The first is the idea that these rates come not directly from the Fed, but this interpretation of what's called a dot plot. And so, you know, they get these economists in a room for 2 days and they all guess where rates are going to be 6 months, 9 months, a year from now. And there's literally, if you Google dot plot, they'll show you that chart. And it's just a guess. And now, is it an educated guess? Sure. But it's an educated guess by government economists or Fed officials. And people just kind of, especially the media, and, you know, if you work in any business that ever gets reported, and every business does, ends up in the crosshairs of the media, you know how quickly they can misinterpret or short interpret what is going on in your world. And they turn around, look at this dot plot, and they're like, well, all these Fed people think we're going to have lower rates in 6 months or 9 months. That's all well and good, but it's not really a forecasting tool. And, you know, the thing that Mr. Powell literally said is we can have rate cuts later this year, quote, as long as the data cooperate. So ultimately, the bond market reaction is limited because future data on the slowing economy can only by definition come later. And I don't know about you, but I, you know, was told when we talk about rates that we're in a situation where rates are going to, you know, in early 2022, rates started going up. And people then said, well, it's only going to be a few months and then they'll moderate. And the question I would ask you right now is, you're driving in your car, you're sitting in your house on Saturday morning. Is there really a place where you think inflation is slowing down, much less falling? I mean, I could mention two, right? Lumber prices and egg prices, which were, you know, a year or two ago, the most expensive things in terms of price increases, but they're not back down to where they were originally. You know, I mean, ultimately, I think that, you know, if you think inflation is really falling, you're fooling yourself. The Fed themselves said in their statement they're looking for cracks in the labor market and they don't see any. And so inflation in products and services is still really high right now. Have you priced insurance lately? Car prices are stubbornly high, new and used. Housing prices haven't come down. Now, part of that is our inventory function, right? We've talked about that at length on this show. But can you point out anywhere where prices are literally falling, not just slowing the acceleration, but falling? I you know, if I wasn't actually the one on the radio, I'd hang up and listen for my answer. But that's not a thing. So it's just not there. We're not going to get meaningful rate cuts that impact mortgage rates until we go months without observing inflation and it recedes from our day-to-day consciousness. Even if the Fed ends up cutting rates due to a political agenda, the bond market's going to see right through that and leave mortgage rates right where they are. So, in fact, rate cuts by the Fed are not warranted by the data. And actually, if they cut aggressively when the data doesn't tell them it's okay to do so, you could actually see mortgage rates increase in that situation as the market determines the Fed is willing to be behind the rate, the curve on inflation, or allow more inflation than they have historically. So bottom line, higher for longer. Make sure you're okay with your mortgage rate and your payment in today's market, because the people who've told folks to marry the house and date the rate a couple of years ago have got those folks into a situationship, and it's not good. And so you need a mortgage at a price that is affordable in today's market and safe for your family's finances. So with all that said, we're going to take a break in a minute. I'm going to remind you that we welcome your calls here today at 773-763-9278 on any topics for mortgage and real estate. And thanks for joining us on the Real Estate Radio Show.
Tune in to Real Estate Radio Saturdays at 9 a.m. hosted by the real estate therapist Larry Shackman, a top-producing real estate broker, author, CEO, and founder of TrustedAgentUSA.com. Top-performing agents for 2% commission, saving you thousands when you sell, buy, or invest. Real Estate Radio, the ultimate real estate radio experience. Get insider tips from experts throughout the real estate industry. Streaming live on Facebook at WCPT 820. Trusted Agent USA, Illinois, license number 475-145-795. Welcome back to Real Estate Radio, sponsored in part by TrustedAgentUSA.com, the ultimate real estate matchmaker, saving you thousands. Now back to Larry, the real estate therapist.
You know, again, not Larry, this is Dylan Kramer, NMLS number 224916 with Neighborhood Loans. And I am sitting in and flying solo today on the Real Estate Radio Show, and I'm excited to have you with us. We welcome your calls at 773-763-9278. We've got about a half hour remaining in the show, and I've kind of riffed early on in the show with a couple of things relative to Mayor Johnson's real estate tax failing this week, the costs of transactions, the Fed rate hike this week and the reaction to that in the market. And with all that said, I think that kind of lays the basis for what we're going to talk about with the rest of the time. And so one of the things I want to do as we get into this is we've got a couple of examples from things going on this week. We're going to talk about real estate story time. So it's either my real estate story time or yours. So don't hesitate to call in at 773-763-9278 if you want to talk a little real estate and mortgage financing. Looks like we've got a caller. We got Craig from Buffalo Grove wants to talk about insurance rates, and that's a great topic. Craig, let's talk about that. How are you today?
All right. How are you?
I am fantastic. I am excited to talk to you. So tell me. Yeah, I bet a dollar I know where you're going with insurance rates, but, you know, the floor is yours. Your dime, your dance floor.
You know, it's just kind of a rite of passage that we compare home insurance rates and auto insurance rates every year. And historically, I find that home insurance rates go up for no other reason other than another year has passed, and auto insurance rates go up for no other reason than a year has passed. I haven't had a claim of either in over 25 years. But this year, auto insurance went down. And home insurance has stayed level. So I can only comment about that. Just a blanket statement about everything else. Gas prices are actually less than they were a year ago, depending on where you're comparing.
Sure.
And I just think that in general, this is an organized effort to keep prices high by retailers and gas companies. But I can just tell you my auto insurance actually went down. Not much.
Well, I'm excited to hear that, Craig, because you know what? Now, I'm a guy who's had claims, but not excessive, I don't think. But, you know, the thing is that for you to have steady or slightly falling rates, I think is a great example. I think that there's some. I appreciate you sharing that relevance. The thing I would say about prices is I agree with you that whether it's companies, and look, obviously companies, I think one of the things on inflation is for years and years, companies figured out a way to not pass through the modest price increases that came through the pipeline. But like with gas prices, like we saw $2 a gallon gas 4 years ago. Now, was it partially pandemic induced? Sure. But then we had $5 a gallon gas, and now we've kind of got $3.40 to $3.60, $3.80, depending on where you're at and what the day is and all that stuff. But it's nowhere near $2 a gallon again. Like, it's lower than it was a year ago. Eggs are lower than they were a year ago. But I would argue that they're not as low as they were at the beginning of this, and we're not going back to that. And I think that goes to your point of the grab on companies. You know, the one thing we're seeing on homeowners insurance, and, you know, it's funny, I mentioned in the first portion of the program, condos, you know, it used to be that you would basically buy the equivalent of a renter's insurance policy as a condo owner's policy, right? And condominium owners will buy a policy that says, hey, you know what, basically I'm going to cover the walls in and my stuff. And for the average condo, that might be $1,000 a year. Well, that's now a $2,000 a year product, period. I don't remember the last time we worked on a mortgage and the mortgage insurance or the mortgage quote from the insurance company or for the loan on any single family home was less than $2,000 or $2,500. It's just gotten really expensive. So thanks to Craig for the call. I appreciate your insight. And I'm excited to talk about anything that you all might have to talk about. Don't hesitate to call us at 773-763-9278. And we'll be happy to talk about real estate and mortgage financing. So let's talk about a couple of real estate stories from this week. I think that we had a very interesting qualifying situations. So let's talk about this one first. I have some folks that I've worked with previously. And I say folks because of the way this shake out. We've got a gal who is a little further along in the path in life, meaning she's not in her 30s. She's probably closer up further along the line with adult children. And she has owned a house. Several houses in an area that's got great high schools, but her kids are college graduates now. And so over the last couple of years, she's been able to turn around and buy a house and experience a significant amount of appreciation. And I think that one of the things, you know, we talk about investing in real estate all the time, but one of the best investments you can make is the house you live in. And what I mean by this is, while she needed the schools, she lived in a house that was probably a $800,000 house in a northern suburb, you know, and could afford that payment on her salary. A few years ago, she transitioned from that house to another house, probably $1 million house, and borrowed about half of that. And can afford the payment on that. And again, you know, I that's a upper middle class type of income and bracket makes sense. But the thing is that in the first house, she had profited a couple of $100,000. She's now in the process of selling this house. It went on the market yesterday. It'll probably be under contract for sale by the time she's up on Monday. And why is that relevant? It's relevant because it is still a fast market if you have property to sell. She's got a target property to buy. And so if she can sell that house she bought 2 years ago for a 30% increase, which is a nice, nice increase, right? So if you can sell that house for $1.3 million, which is the asking, and you take that on the gain, on top of the gain to the other house, pardon me, there's about $600,000 in equity. And so at the end of the run of kind of the chain of adult life in terms of responsibilities, right? I'm going to raise my kids. We're going to need the schools. We're going to pay the taxes. We're going to support that infrastructure and take advantage of those available tools. She's going to walk away with $600,000 in equity. So what's next? Well, in theory, you could do any one of a handful of things, and you could buy a $2 million house and afford the payment. You could buy a mid-level house or a condo, and meaning you could take a smaller mortgage, right? So, you know, this is a person who, as the, you fit this profile, you could buy yourself a $800,000 house and take a $200,000 mortgage with the $600,000 and put that on a 15-year loan and pay it off. And if you're 48, 50, 55, you could have a paid-off house in 15 years or less because you're taking a smaller mortgage with a smaller payment than what you've had previously and get it salted away and paid off. Why is this a great idea? Because, look, we talk all the time on this show, and you've heard Larry and I discuss real estate investment and investing in real estate and buying houses and collecting rents. And there's nothing wrong with that from a real estate portfolio management standpoint. But the one piece of real estate that you absolutely have complete control over is the one you live in when you own it. And at the end of the day, one of the questions I get asked by folks who are considering becoming first-time buyers, considering becoming move-up buyers in this market, is should I do it? And the answer is yeah. And it's because if you're in your late 20s, if you're in your early 30s, geez, if you're in your early 20s, and you look at the market and you say, look, if I can buy a place for $300,000 today, and in 5, 8, 10 years, I can take that equity and move into a place for $500,000. And at the end of 20 more years, you end up with a $200,000 mortgage on a $1 million property. That's a great result. That's $800,000 of equity without all the tax consideration for all the tax savings that you'd have over the course of those years, without consideration for the fact that you didn't have to pay a rent payment for all that time. And if the worst thing that happens to you as an owner of real estate over the course of your lifetime is that you're able to build enough equity in your property to buy the house that you want to retire to, whether that's when you're 48 or 88, and pay cash and live mortgage free, that's a great thing to do. And it's a great thing to do with your primary residence. So you don't have to pay money to real estate gurus. You don't have to end up in a situation where you, pardon me, where you end up in a situation where you have day-to-day challenges with tenants and all this other stuff. If you just own, maintain, and run your own single family home like a business, you could end up with hundreds of thousands of dollars in equity that can help you in the long run. So buying a property is 100% the thing that you should be doing regardless of today's interest rate levels. Again, with the qualifier that you need to be able to safely afford your payment so that you can own your property for the long run. So let's talk a little bit about what does safety look like. Well, at the end of the day, when we go ahead and we pre-approve people for mortgages, I tell people, look, your mortgage is built like three legs of a stool. And those three legs are your equity in the property or your down payment. In the refinance situation, it's the difference between your value and your current mortgage. And then your credit history and your credit report stands good for that. And then it's what's called your debt to income ratio. And everything that you go through in the pre-approval process for a mortgage is really related to answering the questions about one of those three things. Hey, we need your bank statements. Why? Because we need to know where the down payment's coming from. Hey, we need your pay stubs. Why? Because we need to know what you make. We pull your credit report to check your credit history, but also to find out your minimum monthly payments so that we know what the new mortgage payment and your existing payments in life will combine relative to your income. You're self-employed. We need your business tax returns because we have to do the math to calculate what's a mortgage-ready income on a monthly basis. And so oftentimes, you know, people will turn around and say, well, you know, wink, wink, I make more money than that. Well, you know what? When you hide it from the government, you're hiding it from the lenders. And so this is one of the reasons we have jobs in the mortgage business. But ultimately, you want to find yourself in a situation where you get a good working number for your debt to income, and combined with your down payment, you can then look at an idea of, hey, what am I qualified for from a mortgage rate? And if you can make that payment comfortably, exist in the 30-ish percent range of your gross monthly income, you'll be fine. All other things being equal, you know, as long as you don't go out and sign yourself up for $1,000 a month car payment after closing, or, you know, have other, you know, medical tragedies, you know, visit your front door after closing, odds are you'll be fine. And so, you know, it's a good risk. But I think that ultimately the story that I want to get back to or kind of put a bow on is that you can turn around and own property, and it's just the property you live in for 20 or 30 years, and build yourself hundreds of thousands of dollars in equity. And it's just by buying and living in the place that you own. You could literally make yourself a millionaire with that equity. And so ultimately, I think that, you know, one of the challenges when we talk to folks, I talk to financial planners as part of what we do in business. You know, they talk to folks and they're like, well, if you're going to keep up your current expenses in retirement, you're going to need X amount of money, right? So if you have $120,000 salary and you want to have a $120,000 salary in retirement, well, now how do you do that? And that's what financial advisors do in terms of projecting what you need to save. So they say, hey, you got to save $2 million. And if you save $2 million at 5%, you'll have roughly 10 grand a month. It's really 2.3 million at 5%. And so you can live on the 10 grand a month and never touch your principal and you'll be all set. And that's true. But what if you did this math and you owned your own house up until you got to retirement and you were making a mortgage payment of $3,000 a month? And then, and that's just the loan payment, not the taxes and insurance for the purpose of this illustration. And then you woke up and you said, hey, it's time to retire, but I've paid off my house. So now you don't need $10,000 a month. You only need seven, which means you could save 30% less. Or instead of needing, in the financial planner analysis, $2.3 million to retire, you would need $1.7 million because you had a paid off house. And the idea, this is sometimes why people downsize, right? Because if you have, if you're 55, 58, 60, 65, and you're looking to retire, and you say to yourself, well, I've got a $300,000 mortgage on an $800,000 house. Well, you know, you could just sell that house and move to a $500,000 house. And I know, yes, easier said than done. And, you know, you don't know, all our memories are here, blah, blah, blah. I hear all of that. But from a purely financial standpoint, if you can get to a point where you get the equity in your existing house, and then you can move to a house with a smaller or no mortgage, that's your win. That's where you turn around and you break free, because financial freedom happens when what you own, your assets, your money in the bank, your IRA, your 401k, your pension, whatever it is, throw off enough income every month that you can meet your expenses without having to work a job for an income, when your income is basically replaced. And so your real estate, your personal residence, can be a large part of your financial planning tool if you do it right. So I'm not here today to be sour on the idea of owning rental real estate. Like, I've owned rental real estate and I understand it completely. And I think there's tremendous value in being a landlord over time. But it is a job, and it is at a minimum, it's a side hustle. Like, even if you put a manager on your rental real estate, you have to manage your manager. You're having meetings, you're looking at the books. Like, it's not passive. You're participating. And so I would argue for you that if that's not your cup of tea, just don't turn your back on the idea that you can use real estate to solve some of your financial problems for the long run by owning your own place, aggressively getting your mortgage balance down over time, upgrading your house when it makes sense to do so, and moving on from there. So if you have questions about this or you want to talk about it, don't hesitate to give us a call at 773-763-9278. Happy to take your calls about real estate and mortgage financing today. It's no problem at all. We got about 10 minutes left in the show and we're going to keep rolling. So let's talk about another situation that we had come up this week, because I think that it is another great conversation to have. So I'm talking to a buyer, and oddly, this buyer, you know, as I go through my career, and I'm now later in my career, you know, there were times where at the beginning of my career, the buyers were the same age as me, the first time buyers. Then the buyers were a handful of years younger than me. They were my brother's age. Then they were my cousin's age. I'm terrified in life that now the first time buyers are my kid's age. And this gal kind of showed up on our radar after not being paid the time of day by another lender because she's not going to borrow a big amount of money. And, you know, one of the things that really riles me up, and I think that is when people don't represent big commissions, sometimes to the professionals in the real estate and mortgage business, they don't give them the same level of service. And, you know, what does service mean to me in the mortgage and real estate business? It means three things. It means clarity. It means transparency, and it means integrity. Right. And so those things are really important, I think, for the end user of real estate, for the folks who are going to turn around and be part of the equation. And so when that happens, they didn't pay her much mind and she was kind of frustrated. And so what does clarity look like? Well, you know, we got on the phone and we talked a little bit about down payment and monthly payment and what it would take in terms of cash to close, kind of ran through it in detail. I mean, this is a young lady who at 21 or 2 years old has been at a job for a couple of years and has the opportunity to use that income to go buy a townhouse and get her first place. And you know, she's currently living with her parents, would like to not rent, but she has no understanding of how any of this works. And so they basically told her, you're pre-approved for X, and she kind of did that last fall and didn't do anything with it, and then called that lender back and they didn't have the time of day for her. So we spent about an hour on the phone talking through real details about her actual income and the money she's had saved and what it's going to take to come to closing and buy a place. And it turns out, you know, she can buy roughly a $200,000 starter place out in the suburbs. And that's a fantastic thing for her. She's going to need a little bit of help from the sellers in terms of cash flowing the closing, because as I talked about in the earlier segment of the program, transaction costs can be heavy. And there are certain minimums, right? Like at the end of the day, getting your house appraised, which for those of you who don't know, is paying a third party licensed professional whose job it is to tell us the value of properties, pay for their report to tell you and the lender that what you're paying for the house is an accurate and fair value, because lenders don't want to lend, you know, 5% down on $200,000 property if it's worth $175,000, because the loan is for $190,000. And then you owe $175,000. So appraisers defend the lender from lending too much against the property, but it has the byproduct, which lots of things in the lending business do, of protecting the borrower as well. So it protects you from overpaying for the house. So that's a $450 fee. And it's really a $450 fee whether you buy a $200,000 condo or you buy yourself a $800,000 house, right? I mean, it might go up $50 or $100 depending on square footage, but not much. It doesn't get way more expensive till you get over, you know, here's this number again, $1 million in purchase price. So the idea here is that, you know, clarity for her is different than clarity for other customers. It's about, for that first time buyer, it's so often about understanding down payment, monthly payment, cash to close. But we had, you know, some transparency as well. And it's like, hey, how do these fees lay out? How does the real estate commission work, which obviously has been a big topic that we talked about earlier in the program as well. And so once you do all these things and you get yourself into a situation where you go through that, you're like, look, let me just tell you how this thing really works. You know, one of the things that I think is fascinating in our business. I used to work for an employer years ago who prided himself on his ability to use his knowledge of the business of mortgage financing to, quote unquote, professionally confuse his borrowers and his business partners. And he did a lot of business because, and to him, it made him feel smart. Like, I have all these answers and you can't come beyond the red velvet rope of my business. I'll just know that I know these things and it'll be okay. Well, the thing that I've learned And the thing that's happened over the course of the last 10 or 15 years is, look, the internet is the great equalizer, right? And so you watch shows, whether it's real estate, right? And you watch Flip This House, you watch Chip and Joanna Gaines on TV, and they show you how all this stuff works. And you can Google everything in the mortgage business. What are rates today? What's a debt-to-income ratio? How's this whole thing work? But the thing that I've been fascinated by is, you know, we have borrowers semi-regularly. You know, we offer all this transparency and this clarity, but they don't always want to take us up on it. I know. I Googled rates. Yeah, the rate's good. Hey, I was able to use a mortgage calculator. The payment you're telling me is the same payment that makes sense. And so they nod their head and they move on. And then we might be 6 weeks into a transaction and we're going and closing next week, and I get in a phone conversation with them about either the final inspection or how the cash to close works and where they should send the money. And it turns out they have no idea what is happening in this transaction. And it's because all the information in the real estate transaction is available. But the knowledge of the professional comes into play in weaving it together with your personal finances, with your personal transaction, in a way that helps make it flow smoothly and understandably for you. And the gift is, I could tell you how the whole thing works, but you still can't figure it out for yourself. You really can't. It's just, there's too many moving pieces, and this is why you need professionals. And bringing it full circle, not only on the mortgage side where you need a professional, but also on the real estate side. You know, there are so many businesses who have basically said, you know, over the last week that the NAR settlement for them is going to be great because who really needs a realtor anyway? What do they do? Well, I could tell you there's a list of 20 things, from organizing your search to understanding the market that you want to be in, to understanding that school district, to negotiating with those sellers, to there's a dozen things. And so for every person who says, well, you know, my agent really didn't do much, you know, they threw this house on the MLS and by Monday, you know, we had a buyer. Well, pricing it right, getting it staged, making sure it shows well, and getting you the right price in 3 days probably took them 20 years of work and professionalism to figure out how to get there. And that's the gift. And what you're paying for is the 20 years of experience, not the weekend that it took them to sell your house. So that's all I have on the Real Estate Radio Show podcast for today. I want to thank everybody for joining us. It's been great to talk a little bit about the mortgage transaction, the Mayor Johnson's tax defeat, the NAR settlement, and how we go about qualifying people for mortgages. Thanks for the calls, and we look forward to seeing you next Saturday.
Thanks for joining us on Real Estate Radio with your host, Larry Shagman, the real estate therapist and top producing broker. Now go to TrustedAgentUSA.com and save thousands when you sell, buy, or invest. Illinois license number 475-145-795. Tune in next week for the ultimate real estate radio experience.